breath in my back from that one. Okay? So, I'm sorry, I can't.
Okay, I'll use my privilege to train and say that is the one thing that we have to discuss also amongst ourselves.
It's a red herring. And
Vanola and Nadia.
Yeah. Yes, my daughter. I would just like to say thank you for reconnecting us again to the importance of having a radical humanist language,
yes,
and to understand our context powerfully so that we can build a radical vision for the future. I'm just concerned that in South Africa we're getting stuck in this radical language. And also what you said that's very important, the importance of the interface with the state, and you know that's the dialectical, and even the importance of the body of theory of language that has emerged out of Jacqueline's writing.
Yes.
But my concern is that become the end in itself, where before it was a product of struggle.
Yes.
It is now isolated and removed from that collective interaction. And so can you please comment on writing about, you know, the new car?
Yes.
And instead of doing the panel meeting.
Yeah. Nadia?
Thank you, that was wonderful. And I think we need to have a lot more of these kind of conversations. It's energizing, it's just nice to be in a different space. I had two things I'd like you to comment on. And the first one is around language that you spoke about earlier. And I've been finding this a lot, that when you try to talk about racism or race, constructs of race, or whiteness, something happens and people, there's a certain kind of paralysis that happens. And I think that's a problem. I think you did speak about it a little bit. But I'm wondering about how do we try to get some of that language back? When we speak about race in resistant ways, we speak about, feminism, I mean, we know, like you said, you're absolutely right. I mean, there just isn't a language for feminist talk in the world. Well, there is, but it's usually on the world. That's the first thing. Then the second thing was, I think you answered my question later, but maybe you can also comment on it a little bit. You spoke about how the bodies of women and other animals are used as instruments of exchange. And I think you're absolutely right. But I also wonder about how it's part of the patriarchal system to separate people from other animals. And so you spoke about veganism as a way of talking of, well, the future of feminist politics, I think, and I agree with you, in many ways, in having that kind of discussion around the links. But I find that immediately when people start, when you start to talking about it, you almost made a little apology. And you said you don't want to preach about it. And I find that it's really difficult to have that kind of language, not only in South Africa, but in most places in the world. That the minute you try to start speaking about connections around human beings and other animals, there's usually in South Africa the response is that, but we have black people who are starving. Is there a way to talk about the connections in through a feminist language without using that kind of argument around race and poverty?
Yeah. Well, let me start with the last one. Oh, and I just want to say for the people who are leaving, if you would like to have a copy of the paper, we should just circulate a piece of paper with your email addresses on it. But those who are at UWC, I suppose, I can... But for people, I know that you're at the UWC at the Quality and Equality Unit. It's nice, good to see you again. And I'm sure that Mary can facilitate for that. But for other people, please just, let's just get a piece of paper and circulate it, and I will just go on the email and just click it to you. Because some of the things sound more clear or are more sort of provocative, maybe, when you're reading it yourself and you can sort of interact and, you know, open it up a little bit. So, and I would like to share the paper with you So if somebody can take the initiative and just send a piece of paper. Oh, thanks, Bernie. It's coming. Okay, thanks. And thank you for being here. Yeah, I think I want to start with the veganism thing. I will unlearn that apology. That is in sort of, and it is a way of stancing in an uncomfortable, in a vacuum, so that one begins to use language that that is supposedly unthreatening, because there's this tremendous backlash, and people shut off. They don't want to hear what you're saying, you know, because it's the familiar, it's the norm, and they really already are dealing with a lot of stuff, and they don't want to have to, you know, and that's what collusion does. Collusion creates a sense of comfort in us that makes things that need to be changed eventually become normal, especially in class times. You know, so yeah, you know, I'll jog and I'll work out, and but I'll eat the meat and I'll eat the chicken, and I'll look for, you know, the chickens that run around that are not in a hatch or in a box or in a cage. But when we think about ourselves, if we were in cages, and it's establishing that connectivity, you know? And I don't know how to do it. It's really very, very new for me. I've been vegan for almost 20 years, but my being vegan is still treated as other by the shops, by the caterers, you know? And it's like I remember just weeping with anguish, because I was so hungry, because I couldn't get any food at a conference in Brazil. And after a week, and being told by people who were carrying these plates with loads of dead animals on them, you know, I mean, like heaps and heaps and heaps of animal protein, you know, and telling me, oh, there's some salad over there. Why don't you check with the salad? Some of them would even try to help me. Oh, I saw the salad that doesn't have cheese in it. And then, of course, there would be a little piece of ham hiding somewhere, you know. And just as it comes towards my mouth, there it drops down. And then I know, oh, I could smell it, you know. So that experience with insisting on becoming vegan, I did it, first of all, for my body. I refused to cut a part of my body out. And the doctor very sort of, in a blasé way, said, well, then you have to stop eating meat, you know. And that took me on that path, you know. And it opened up my politics in ways that was just extraordinary. And I've just continued because it's so wonderful. And the growth in that along that path is so tremendous. And so I've been able to be resilient and to enjoy. You continuously are asked really stupid questions. So the other thing is that, you know, it requires a collective conversation, because you can't really change a social system alone. That's why all women must be radical, so that we can make the changes that need to be done. You know, and everybody must stop eating dead animals. You know, so that we can actually transform our world. They blame global warming. Oh, you know, it's those Americans and Europeans spewing out the poison into the northern hemisphere. And then, you know, but actually, a lot of it is linked with agriculture, with what we eat. You know, we must debunk the claims that white farmers in this region fed us. They didn't feed us. They grew crops that were not edible for humans, that are translating into this diabetes, you know, epidemic, and they destroyed all the biodiversity with the monocrop production, you know. And we have to debunk those claims, because when they make those claims that South Africa will never make it without white farmers, and the new commercial farmers are doing exactly the same. So there's so many layers that we need to engage with and debunk, so that we can begin to live our lives personally and individually differently, but also to have the social movements. So I think being vegan is...
is the way to go. But how to make it a critical political issue to create the discursive sites is the challenge. Race and privilege, well, you know, I found that, yeah, it's really exhausting. And, you know, it's actually boring. But it's so on our necks and our backs. You know, the denial of privilege goes hand in hand with the enjoyment of privilege. And until people actually acquire the consciousness that enables them to say, I don't want this privilege, to abandon that privilege, they don't want you to tell them that they're not privileged. And it's that warped perspective. And I think that the notion of privilege is a more effective discursive tool than race. Not only because race is a marker that is obvious and that is so stuck in the quagmire of reconciliation and all that stuff that goes with it, but also because when you talk about privilege, you make people think about themselves in relation to systems rather than in relation to guilt and horrific brutalities that were committed in their name, even if they were not there, which is really one of the lamest. You know, young white people, for example, say, I never owned any slaves. I mean, I never enslaved anybody. And you're like, okay, now, it'll take me 100 years to actually get this person to understand that it's more than just... So I think we need these discursive spaces where we can talk about the vehicles that enable us to communicate and to grow and to also engage, so that those who need to take responsibility must take responsibility. Not the way Tutu frames it and benefits from it, by the way, but rather in terms of the solidarity that we need to build so that people understand. For example, men who live with women and the man changes the nappies, the diapers they're called now. And then when you tell him that he's a sexist, actually, and he can actually rape, because rape is a form of violence that is deployed by men. Any man can deploy it on the body of a woman or a female. They become extremely upset. How dare you? I'm not a rapist. And they use this argument that black men have been constructed as rapists. I'm like, no, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the impunity, the supremacy, that maleness draws from patriarchy. That's what we're talking about here. But the accusation that, how dare you call me that, shuts down the conceptual connection with privilege and with, of course, violation as an extension of very warped forms of privilege, of sexualized privilege. So I think we should, it's time that we talk more and talk more closely and with greater courage, you know. I understand that there's a new women's movement in the Cape. Maybe somebody would share with us what that means, because I've always been really excited by it when I hear that, but then I haven't really been able to. And then I'll come to your question, Vanda. New women's movement.
We've started in 90 minutes.
Yeah.
Can you tell your opportunity?
Okay.
And I think that...
I'm actually a member of the women's.
My question comes from
me. Okay. Well, I think that the only way that we are going to be able to create a feminist movement is that we have to make a distinction between the women's movement, which has been, and I was a gendered nationalist for a long time, until I unburnt it. I still articulate nationalist sentiments, which is why I made reference to the nationalization issue and why I was looking at myself and saying, wait a minute now, you know, where's this nationalism coming from? Okay, it's like being a Roman Catholic, they mark you at birth, and for the rest of your life, you'll be saying Jesus Christ and Holy Mary and Joseph, you know? So I think that we need to make certain conceptual leaps in the ways in which we understand how women's politics has to change, how women's politics has to become radical politics for us,
Other women will continue to do politics in other ways that are linked with how they socially reproduce themselves, what they're comfortable with, if they don't mind colluding, etc. But for those of us who identify ourselves as radicals, who, for example, operate outside the system, like me, I don't operate in the system at all. I just tiptoe in and out, you know? Yeah, even then, you know, I'm like watching the door because I can't wait to get out. Because I know that I can't trust my radicalism in conservative reactionary sites. The influences are tremendous, you know, and the seductions. So it's a constant battle. But when we have solidarity and we embrace the radical identity, then we find the other ways of doing the work. Then we can begin, I think, to build a feminist movement. Because we don't have a feminist movement in Africa. We had a women's movement. Mm-hmm. But most of it has been conflated into the state or chewed up by the donors, you know, that become employees of donor agencies and of, you know, NGO is no longer non-governmental. It's really, maybe it should be said in the reverse.
No indication.
That's right. So we need to craft the new sites. We need to do it for ourselves. Because that's the only way that change happens, and the way we change ourselves and change our lives is when we do it. And we can't. And, you know, that's why resistance is so important. That's why creativity is so important. That's why autonomy is so important.
Thank you so much, Juliana. You can ask Patrick
now. Yes. I'm sitting and I'm boiling.
Oh, wow.
I think coming back to Desiree's comments earlier about, you know, feeling challenged. I'm really grappling with my own issues around feminism and Africanism, and I guess I'm not gonna. I have a lot of questions that I want to ask, and my question is, how can I, as a black privileged woman sitting here at UCT, continue this conversation?
Yeah.
Online, you know, yes. As a privileged woman bridging the gap of the digital divide, and really just. Continue this conversation because I feel like there's a lot of contradiction and you know that is happening and like I said I'm basically there's a lot of questions that I feel like we need to listening to Bayanola's question around you know sort of new thinking and alternative ways of organizing as women.
Okay. Well, I think that discomfort is always a good it's a good sign. It for me when I feel discomfort, I'm brushing against the grain of my comfort zone. And the issue of privilege needs also to be closely looked at. I mean, do you own a factory? No, I'm serious. I'm very serious.
Yeah,
the translation of your entitlement to education and knowledge into a privilege is a problem. You know, privilege is institutionalized access to continuous streams of wealth, which is what Oppenheimer and De Beers and all those people, own. You see, but your access to a knowledge site where you can grow and think and write and explore and use your creativities to change the world.
And I guess, but again, it comes to, you know, to defining what that means, because we have these, all of these terms and messaging around, you know, we have all of these terms that we use in this feminist world and terminology that we don't really define in ways that is
it's true. A lot of it is fake and hoax. But, you know, don't worry. We'll sort of try to clear the forest of the stuff that is... from engagements like these. So I have resisted passing on my intellectual property rights to males who make money out of radical women's work and writing. I see it that way. And so I don't often give a publisher the ownership of what I write. So I put it on the net. It's available, you can have it. Yeah, you have access. So if you Google, for example, you know, you're welcome. And then engage me. Send me, you know, whatever it is that's going through your mind. But I think disrupting the property, the intellectual property rights regimes is really an important issue for us. I mean, it can be interpreted as fear of criticism, but maybe, you know, but hey, I put myself out in the public so much that if I was scared, I should be in a dark corner sucking my thumb. So I just want to say that it's my gift to all radical women and women who haven't yet decided that they want to be radical. So please go on the internet and just enjoy. And please also put your radical stuff there so that I can also grow and harvest.
Okay, thank you so much.